WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio presents Lehigh Valley Discourse. Provocative, informative, and newsworthy, Lehigh Valley Discourse brings you the people and the issues that move and shape our region here on WDIY. Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm James Johnson. Today we welcome Reverend Dr. Larry Pickens, the Ecumenical Director for the Lehigh Conference of Churches, who leads efforts to unite communities of faith in the Lehigh Valley and foster the greatest cooperation possible among diverse religious perspectives. We are living in a moment of intense change regarding systemic racism, police brutality, and social injustice. Our conversation covers his perspectives on those topics and his own journey with faith. Welcome, Reverend Dr. Larry Pickens. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm fine, James.
Thank you again for making time for WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio.
Sure thing. It's my pleasure. I appreciate what you do and how you inform the public, so I am happy to be a part of that ongoing process.
Well, thank you again. Tell us a little bit about your path through faith. How did you get involved in religion? And obviously a little bit of background about yourself, if you'd like.
I grew up in Chicago and not in a particularly religious family, but one that was very socially active. And my parents exposed me to the civil rights movement, and Chicago was very, very pivotal to that movement, particularly with Dr. King's engagement and Jesse Jackson and others. That was really a formative part of my development. Later, I went to a Christian college, put that in quotation marks, Christian college, North Park University, which is connected to the Evangelical Covenant Church. And it's a conservative and evangelical pietistic denomination. So I never thought about becoming a part of that. My roots were primarily Baptist growing up, but as I said, not really a practicing Christian or Baptist. But when I was at North Park, I wanted to explore a faith, religion, and decided to attend, after graduation, Garrett Evangelical Seminary, which is a United Methodist seminary. And I went there really out of curiosity and not really planning to get ordained. But the more I got involved in it, it seemed like that was really the path that I needed to really be open to. And so I decided to become United Methodist and got ordained in the church, and also serve now in a United Church of Christ congregation here locally, St. Peter's United Church of Christ. And it's allowed me to stay in the arena of a local church as well as serving in the ecumenical arena with the Lehigh Conference of Churches. And my experience or exposure to the ecumenical movement and interfaith efforts is quite extensive. I have served in leadership at the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches of Christ in the U.S. and various other ecumenical endeavors. And always, for me, that includes social justice concerns. So that's been a part of my life now, really since early on when my parents nurtured that in me, and even today as I engage my work here in the Lehigh Valley.
Reverend, would you please explain for our listeners what an ecumenical director is and how it facilitates within the Lehigh Conference of Churches?
Sure. I'm still figuring that out myself, so your listeners are right with me. I am responsible for engaging faith communities, whether they are Christian or other faith partners, around common concerns, and to also give them opportunities to engage the work that we do, which is centered around homelessness and providing ministry opportunities with people who are mentally ill. And that means there are opportunities for our faith communities to volunteer, to financially support what we do. And on another level, one of the things that I've tried to do is find ways that we can partner on issues of mutual concern. So whenever issues arise around anti-Semitism or Islamophobia or LGBTQ rights, those are ways in which we can come together as faith leaders to talk about how we can advocate for those who oftentimes don't have people standing behind them. So that's what I do as the ecumenical director, and I search to find ways to build communities and create advocacy for people who oftentimes don't have a voice.
Seems like you're the great connector.
That's what I try to do. I'm the guy that puts people together, and I think that's a good way to describe what I do. I network pretty well. For example, I got a call last week from Senator Casey's office wanting to have conversations with Black pastors in the Lehigh Valley. So I contacted the Black pastors with whom I've worked, and I said, hey, Senator Casey wants to talk to you about COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter and policing issues. Are you open to having that conversation? And the response was yes. So that will happen. So, that's kind of a role that I like playing and connecting people around some essential issues that we're confronting as a community.
Let me hit you with absolute kind of your own reaction to what is going on right now in our society. I'm referring to the social injustice and the Black Lives Matter and George Floyd, but just your absolute raw reaction, how do you feel?
That's a real good question. I was thinking about that this weekend. I got a chance to watch the Hamilton production that Disney produced. And when you look at how the nation was started, it was a fragile experiment. And I think that it is true that racism and xenophobia was very much a part of the original sin of this country from its very inception. And I don't think we can escape that or deny it. I think what's happening now is that there is a great reckoning that's taking place in our nation that's moving these voices that have for a long time not been coalesced to being in a setting where they can be heard. And we're bringing Black voices and brown voices and LGBTQ voices and white voices and Asian voices, Muslims, Jews. All of these voices are coming together around a common concern regarding Black lives and the significance of how that struggle is not simply a Black struggle, but it's the struggle that all of us are engaging. And I think with that coalescing of voices, there's a greater, I would say, a greater significance to the way in which that is being heard today. We've sort of come to a greater consensus around these issues. I also think that the political landscape that we find ourselves in today, particularly around the culture wars, and this past weekend we've heard this kind of romanticizing about the Confederacy and the history of all of that, and I think that clash is really impacting our country. And I'm finding that the people who are in the middle, the moderates, and a lot of the white people who may have even been Republicans, for example, are deciding now they can no longer countenance that drift that we find ourselves in today. And I don't even know if you could call it a drift. I think that that's always been the way that message has been conveyed in this context. But I think that's my raw assessment of what's going on. And I think that it's a retelling, this line that I heard this week of people trying to destroy history. It's not a destruction of history that's happening. It's a retelling of history that speaks to the reality that communities that never had a voice in shaping that history are now bringing to fruition. And I would rather see it that way, because I don't think history is static. I think we all end up seeing history in the context of where we are in our present. And that's always being shaped by some realities that come to the forefront. And I think that that is what is happening in our country today. And in fact, it's not only in our country, it's global. It's, you know, when I saw people in Berlin and Paris marching, it struck something in me. And then when I saw people marching in Salt Lake City, Utah, I told people there are not many brothers and sisters in Salt Lake City, Utah. So something's going on in this country. So that's my picture of how to analyze the landscape today.
You'd mentioned in the opening that you'd obviously been from Chicago. Your parents had involved you in social topics and made you aware of equality and the fight for that in the 60s with Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. How does this moment differ from moments in the past for ethnic equality? I'll just use 28 years ago, Rodney King in Los Angeles as another pivotal moment besides the 60s. How does this moment differ from moments in the past for ethnic equality?
I think that in the past, there was a great deal of people power related to the civil rights movement, but there was also even a willingness in government. You had a president like Lyndon Johnson who moved a lot of legislation on civil rights, you know, with the help of Dr. King and others. So I think that at that point, there was more of a partnership. And of course, that partnership never would have happened without people agitating and pushing. I think now that in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, it had such resonance with so many people regarding what is wrong with our country as it relates to race. And, you know, one of the things I am aware of, for example, is that the civil rights movement never took on mass incarceration or criminal justice reform. So what's happening today is just such an expansive picture of what needs to take place in order to really transform our society. And inclusive in that is policing, and not only policing, but what happens to young black males and young black women when they get entangled in the criminal justice system, and what impact that has on communities and families. And I just don't think that you can divorce these realities from this movement. And I think that's what makes this time so different. We never thought about those things in the 60s, not to the extent that we do now. And the other part, I think, is that this movement has gained so much more resonance. And I understand that there were white people who supported the civil rights movement. But I think it's the regular people. It's the young people who are out there on the streets. It's the people who are speaking up and making their voices heard that are making an impact. It's women who have decided that they are going to be counted and will not be ignored. It's groups that historically even have not been connected to this type of movement who are now engaged. And I think that has made all of the difference in regard to why this is gaining so much support and resonance today. And I believe that it's something that has to be sustained. We have to keep it moving. But I believe, you know, Dr. King used to say, now is the time. I believe now is the time to seize this moment in order to really begin changing this country for the better with respect to black and brown lives.
How does technology help those in the quest for true equality and justice?
That's also an interesting question. I've been thinking about that because I was reading about this concept of truth and technology and you know, just the whole use of social media and this conversation that we've been having in this country about how we are to interpret news that is shared with us, whether it's true, whether it's fake news, or how do we evaluate information. And I think that, you know, even as we find ourselves in this pandemic, it's hard for us to get a straight understanding of what it is that we're supposed to be doing because of the many mixed messages that are being conveyed. And this is one of the challenges of technology in terms of how we use it and just what truth means. And I think that truth is really about having an integrity about oneself that engages science and one's experience and then interprets what that means for a broader population and community. And there's no doubt that technology, social media has played a significant role in pushing this movement that's taking place. And I think that that's an important element of carrying out what it is that has started. I also think that technology can be a challenge for us, particularly when we raise issues around surveillance and the impact that it has upon our privacy and our rights as people. So I think there's a balancing act that has to take place. And around this issue of free expression, I think the Supreme Court decision that I'm reminded of is that we have freedom of speech, but not to yell fire in a crowded theater. I think that that measurement should create maybe a border for us when we think about what we are free to talk about, what we're free to espouse, and what carries in terms of what truth really is as we evaluate the words that we articulate.
You've been listening to Reverend Dr. Larry Pickens, Ecumenical Director for the Lehigh Conference of Churches, here on Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. We'll return after these important messages.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar, every Thursday from 7 to 9, here on WDIY.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. Our guest today is Reverend Dr. Larry Pickens, Ecumenical Director of the Lehigh Conference of Churches. Reverend, has systemic racism affected you in your personal journey with faith?
Absolutely. Systemic racism is evident in the church I serve, that I've served. The United Methodist Church has systemic racism. The United Church of Christ, which I'm serving in a dual capacity, has it. And yes, systemic racism is a reality. I'll give you a good example of what I'm talking about. I grew up in a community called Inglewood, and Inglewood historically was a pretty significant community. There were a lot of Eastern Europeans who first moved there 100 years ago, and they built nice homes, apartments, that kind of thing. And as the community began to change in the 50s and 60s, something happened. Realtors and insurance companies started redlining the community. So they actually drew red lines around that community, which meant that banks would no longer give loans to those communities. It meant that insurance costs would be astronomical if you wanted to insure your home. It meant that it would be difficult to secure new business coming into the community. So what happened to that community was that it accelerated the loss of banks and businesses and services that had been bedrocks in that community for many years. And after this kind of intentional, systematic planning that was taking place, not only on the business level, but even in the halls of political process, that community was simply decimated. So that's an experience that I saw. I lived it. I I experienced it in the context of not only the direct animosity that white people had when we moved into that community, but it was being played out in a whole other arena that we had no real ability to impact or transform. So yes, systemic racism is a reality, and that's the struggle that we still engage in many of our communities. Where you live, your zip code has a lot to do with determining what your life is going to be like. And that is as true in 1960 as it is today.
Well, it seems, Reverend, that as much as President Johnson made all these strides forward with the late 60s and the civil rights movement, then those in political power created new systems, redlining, things like that. Is it just about moving the goalposts, or is there going to be a stop and a true leveling of the playing field?
I think that it's an ongoing process. I listened to someone like John Lewis talk about the progress that has been made. And it's true, there's been a great deal of progress in this country. And, you know, going back to that Hamilton analogy, I think that what they started was really something that would continue to evolve. And I think part of the evolution is finding ways to address the challenges that we face in unique ways. You know, maybe it's a kind of a, we should look at it like a pandemic, like this virus that we're fighting. It changes. It mutates. It does different things that we didn't anticipate. And maybe that's what racism does. It changes and mutates, and we have to find different ways to attack it. And that doesn't mean that we should give up because it comes back in other forms. It just, in my mind, means that we have to be even more persistent and working to eradicate it. And I think that that's how I would like to see it in terms of not that we failed, but that we simply have to keep fighting this epidemic, this pandemic that we call racism.
You mentioned at the Candlelight Vigil the other night, dangerous difference. What is the dangerous difference that each of us has?
The dangerous difference for me is that we all have the ability to not allow ourselves to conform to a society where racism, sexism, homophobia are norms. We all have the ability to put our no to the idea that there is somehow something to be redeemed from a history of the Confederacy. And it means that in articulating that no, we are in many ways embracing our dangerous difference. We're not going along with the notion that in order to live our lives, we have to conform or get along with injustice. And I think that that's really the responsibility that we have as people to not engage injustice. And I think that that's why people are on the streets protesting, because they have decided that they want to speak up for justice. And that's, a lot of these people have never done this before, but there's something that is inspiring them. And I want to suggest that that's part of the dangerous difference that inspires people to really embrace justice and also to stand with people who are in need. To me, it's really an expression of when a community is in need, those of us who have the capacity to help them should do so. And I think that that's what's happening around Black Lives Matter. There are people who have decided that they want to be counted on the right side of history and be a part of helping our community embrace our humanity. And that's an important piece. I shared this concept with a group I spoke to recently at Knesset Israel Synagogue. And I told them that their dangerous difference is that they really live a dilemma. And the dilemma, I told them, is that they're Jews and they're white. And with that, with being a Jew means that they are a hated people. And being white means that there are certain trappings that they can embrace as a result of the color of their skin.
Mm-hmm.
And part of their schizophrenia is having to decide, which am I? And I said to them, you have more in common with your Jewish tradition and faith than you do with your whiteness. And that really your struggle needs to become embracing who you are as a people and not your whiteness. And I think that that's what I'm getting at around this whole concept of dangerous difference and being able to embrace the power of what it means to be a community of people who are standing on justice and not on white supremacy.
Powerfully said. Can you share with our listeners a little more detail about the Lehigh Conference of Churches initiative to end racism?
We've started some conversations around that with respect to a planned study that we are engaging in the next week around white fragility and how we can open up the conversations around race and racism with white people. And that will be the beginning of significant dialogue around that issue. We're talking about this within the context of the Conference of Churches as we have decided to engage in anti-racism training for our staff and the board of directors, because we feel that we need to model this as a Conference of Churches as we begin to address these issues of racism and you know, truthfully, deal with our own systemic racism. Our Interfaith Steering Committee is engaging or planning to engage the police chiefs of Allentown and Whitehall to talk about these issues that have come to the forefront around policing and communities of color, because we think that that's an important conversation in our context here within the Lehigh Valley. So those are some steps that we've started at the Lehigh Conference of Churches, not as expansive as perhaps they need to be, but I think it's a good beginning for us to really making ourselves more conscious and aware and making our agency more credible as it relates to social justice and the way in which we engage our communities.
Can you share any consensus from the faith community regarding the Allentown Police Department and the Bethlehem Police Department's recent release of use of force policies?
I have not heard any consensus. You know, I belong to a clergy group that engages these conversations. I do know that there have been concerns expressed in the Allentown context. I'm more familiar with that one around policing and the relationship with the Hispanic community in Allentown, and there have been some concerns raised about policing in that area, but I could not expansively discuss that. I do know that, in fact, we just had a meeting this morning with our interfaith group, so one of the things we will be looking at is what the Bethlehem and Allentown police communities have said about the use of force, and that's also going to be part of that conversation. But no consensus that I'm aware of related to churches. In fact, I haven't heard a lot of response to documents that have been produced yet, but hopefully out of these conversations, and one of the things I suggested to our group is that we have a series of conversations on different issues, so I'm sure that this is going to be one that we bring to the table. And I think we should also, as part of that, engage our faith communities to ask them, you know, whether there is a consensus or what is the perspective on the use of force. And then the other question we've talked about is, you know, what does defunding police departments mean? And that's another conversation that we intend to have with the two police chiefs.
Reverend, last question. What gives you hope with residents, citizens, and neighbors of the Lehigh Valley with all the things, the COVID-19, systemic racism, social injustice, what gives you hope moving forward?
The young people, because I feel that they will not carry our baggage. I feel that they are charting their own course, and they are showing us some things that we need to understand about community building. And that gives me hope. When I see them out in the streets, when I see them engaged in developing their communities, that gives me a hope. And I also see them crossing racial and cultural barriers in order to do it. They have developed an ability to connect across many barriers that have stymied a lot of us historically. And that gives me hope that the world that they're creating will be a lot different and a lot better from the one that we have been instrumental in creating ourselves. So that's why I'm hopeful. And that's why I like to keep young people around me, because they give me a sense of energy and help me see possibilities that I have trouble conceiving. So that's what gives me hope today.
The future is in their hands.
Yes, sir.
Let me thank Reverend Dr. Larry Pickens, the Ecumenical Director for the Lehigh Conference of Churches, for joining us here on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Thank you so much.
After these short messages, we'll return with more Lehigh Valley Discourse with author Sally Handlin and her new book, Your Journey to Aging Well. We'll be right back.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY. Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11 offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
If you ever get annoyed, look at me, I'm self-employed. I love to work at nothing all day. And I've been taking care of business every day. Taking care of business every way. I've been taking care of business. It's all mine. Taking care of business and working overtime. Work out.
Sally Handlin has been an active member of the Lehigh Valley business and nonprofit community for more than 40 years. During that time, she became familiar with wellness and the environment, both passionate hobbies. In 2018, she created the website bodyconstruction.me and began the process of gathering her 30 years of experience and information together on paper to share with the world in her first published book. Congratulations, Sally, and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Thanks, James. It's a pleasure to be here and on this side of the mic.
That is correct. Sally Handlin is a board member of WDIY and a host of Lehigh Valley Discourse herself. Let me start off with, when did you first recognize the importance of personal health?
Well, I think I was probably in my late 20s, so that was the 1980s, when I had some minor ailments, and I found a chiropractor. And he was very much into alternative, obviously, as a chiropractor professional. And his name is Justin Kelly, and he did a lot to educate me as to the body healing itself. So that was the beginning of it. And then I started reading Prevention Magazine. I got a subscription, and I really loved the words and the articles that Prevention provided, and actually the encouragement. And eventually I became a member of a board that Ardith Rodale was on. So I got even, more knowledge between she and her husband about alternative health, about regeneration. And a big thing then for me was regeneration.
What about regeneration? What is that about? If you can explain for our listeners a little bit more about what you've learned.
Well, the regeneration, there's actually was two levels, and it's the regeneration of the person. So taking time and being quiet and doing mindful things and meditation help to regenerate you as an individual and help you to be able to pursue whatever it is that you want to do more effectively and more appropriately, more balanced. And regeneration of the community was really something I was getting involved in because I was involved in the South Side and I was involved in First Fridays and trying to regenerate the South Side. And what happened was Bob Rodale talked about regenerating a community through accenting the positives. You don't blow up the negatives and try and address all the negatives. What you do is you work from the positives and you sort of fit out all of the negatives by doing that. And that, to me, made a whole lot of sense.
And then you'd mentioned Prevention Magazine, but what were some of your other early resources, references, or guides to how you've compiled all this information over 30 years?
Well, I did a lot of research. I mean, I started before the internet really became something of value. So it was a lot of magazines that I read, and a lot of them were women's magazines. But Prevention was predominantly the one that I used, and that's where I got information about some of the health professionals in the area, the alternative health professionals, and I began to follow them as individuals. Sometimes I was just reading their articles. Sometimes I went to seminars that they had. I was just trying to be a sponge and gather as much as I could.
And then how did you discover alternative medicine and herbal wellness along your path?
Oh, David Winston. David was a contributing writer to Prevention Magazine. He is also a world-renowned herbalist that just happens to be over in New Jersey, in Washington, New Jersey. And I went to a seminar or two of his that he had in the greater Philadelphia area and really enjoyed what he had to say and learned more about that he had actual courses that herbalists took and learned more how to understand the herbs and the plants and what their capabilities were, the ability to work with clients and understand what their needs were and how to bring them to a balance or homeostasis. And so I basically followed up in 2005 and contacted David and started his 2-year program in 2006. I was probably one of the oddballs in the class, because I was just starting my Hanlon Business Resource business at the same time. So I had to put most of my energies behind the business. But we studied over, 200 herbs. So you look at the Ayurvedic, you look at the Chinese, you look at the Indian, American Indian, you look at everything and try and understand what their properties are and what their healing capacity is. So it was eye-opening, and don't ask me to repeat all these herbs because I keep a reference book at my desk all the time so I can use that.
Well, explain for our listeners what is integrative nutrition and how it derives, obviously, from your, again, path with wellness, herbs, and others.
Integrative nutrition is really looking at the whole individual. So you're looking beyond food. And Joshua Rosenthal, who developed the course and the school that I attended, Integrative Nutrition, basically said there's two plates of menus that we have to consider. And the first plate is actually the most important. It's the primary plate. The secondary plate is the food. So the primary plate really is understanding what he called the circle of life. So if you are balanced in your spirituality, in your physical activity, in your career, in relationships, and there's about 12 subtitles underneath those 4 key areas, if those things are in balance, then your diet really isn't a problem or your weight really isn't a problem. It's when we are lacking or deficient in one of those areas that we tend to make up for it by going to the refrigerator, hitting the snack foods, the stuff that really is not very good for our bodies. So if we can understand ourselves better and understand where we are in those 4 key areas and the subtopics, then that helps us to have a more balanced approach to the way that we eat. And that leads us into the secondary plate, which, obviously, like with all good nutritional advice, you want to have the fruits and the vegetables and a balance of carbs and proteins and fats. Those are all good for you. So the program in integrative nutrition was a year program. I took it in 6 months. So I did a double up because I wanted to get done quickly because I wanted to start my book. My intention has always been to write a book. So I took the course, I studied that, and really I learned by experimenting on myself what integrative nutrition was. So I rated myself on the primary food, and then I began to look at the secondary food. And so over time, over those 6 months, I can say that I'm a product of understanding what indeed they preach.
How did it feel to be a guinea pig?
Actually, I enjoy it. I enjoy testing myself to see, number one, what do I feel, and how is it working? And do I have the perseverance to, you know, do it for 2 weeks, do it for 3 weeks. And then at the end of that, I do an analysis. Okay, how do I feel? What's better? What's not? And I will tell you, I still eat chocolate. I still eat ice cream. And I have my glass of wine on Friday nights.
Sounds healthy to me. Share with our listeners the path to writing this book and some of the easiest parts as well as the hardest parts of your journey.
Well, the seed for the book actually got planted back in David's class in 2006 because the information that I was learning, I just wanted to share with people. I've always been a trainer at heart. When I worked for Meridian Bank, I was a trainer in the retail division. I did corporate training as well. So I've always done research and tried to share what I've learned. And there seemed to be some core themes that went through David's class that I thought, geez, if people just understood that, and if they really took time to think about, you know, their habits, their actions, you know, they'd be healthier. At the same time, my mother, who was then in her late 80s, early 90s, was on the sort of the downhill side of her life. And she was on so many medications. It just really frustrated me because I couldn't find anybody to really explain why. I mean, one medication was offsetting the side effects of the other medication. So she was on 15 medications. I learned in David's class that our body can process maybe 5 effectively. And so here I am, my mom's, you know, 3 times that, and I don't know enough to go up against the doctors to be able to say anything. I went to the pharmacist and I said, can you give me the printout of what these medications are and what they cause? And I ended up with probably 50 to 60 pages of information that I couldn't read because I didn't understand. It was all in technical terms. So I was just really frustrated. So the timing seemed to be right, unfortunately, not to help my mother, but that I could help others, including myself, so that I wouldn't have the same path that she had.
Let's take a moment to reintroduce you. My guest today on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Sally Handlin and her new book, Your Journey to Aging Well, Drink, Move, Eat, and Sleep. We'll be right back after these important messages.
In a fast-paced world, it's sometimes hard to separate fact from fiction. And that's where NPR's weekday news program, Morning Edition, comes in. We'll help you fend off information overload by bringing you the news that matters most. I'm Renee Montaigne. Tune out the fiction and tune in to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tune in weekday mornings at 5 a.m. for news as well as local weather and traffic here on WDIY.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Pocono Cheesecake Factory, now offering curbside pickup of a variety of cheesecake, cookies, pastries, and gourmet treats. For 35 years, helping schools, clubs, and other nonprofit organizations throughout the Lehigh Valley and Northeast Pennsylvania achieve their fundraising goals. The Pocono Cheesecake Factory, since 1985, love at first bite. For more information, PoconoCheesecake.com. Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse, where we join Sally Handlin and her new book, Your Journey to Aging Well, Drink, Move, Eat, and Sleep. As far as the process of writing the book itself and getting it published, was there any easy or hard parts that you can describe?
I think the biggest challenge, James, was pulling all this information. I had 3 years of study with David. I had 2 years with the herbs, and then I had another year as a clinical end of that. You know, what herbs do you put together to be able to affect a change? So I had that, and that was, you know, 2006 to 2009. And so everything that was in a box in the attic. And so I had to start going through that. Obviously, integrative nutrition was a little bit more recent because that was 2018, 2019 that I took that class. But I had to figure out how do I combine these two? What's the message that I really want to share? What is important for people to know? And how can I help them understand better? Because there's so much information out there on the internet. I mean, I just read yesterday, there was something in one of the feeds I get that had 12 nutritionists talking about different things you should do. And it's like, heavens, that's too much. You know, you need to figure out for you. So what I wanted to do was, how do I position this so that people can get out the most of it for themselves? I'm not preaching. I'm not saying you should do this or you should do that. But what I'm saying is, if you make these choices, these are the consequences. So you need to understand, and if you make that choice, that's fine, like me and my wine on Friday nights. You know I'm going to be a pound heavier Saturday morning, but, you know, that's a choice I make. And so that was probably the biggest challenge. And so I spent let's see, this is 2020. I spent last summer, the full summer, pulling all this research together, trying to figure out what my outline is, all the pieces that go to it. If you have a chance to read my book, you'll see that there's an awful lot of references there. My background is that I do business plans for businesses, so I'm used to doing a lot of research, and I try and vet it as best possible. So trying to pull all that together was the challenge. The easy part, once I had it pulled together, was just writing the story. And it sort of flowed. And along with that, I found a great publisher, Jennifer Bright, who's with Mimosa Publishing here in Hellertown. And she has great wealth of knowledge, a good staff, and she was able to sort of guide me along the way. I knew what I wanted. I knew what my time frame was. I just needed somebody that had the professional knowledge to be able to sort of round me out.
Is the book meant for men, women, or both?
It is for anybody. My target market initially, because I did some experimenting in my integrative nutrition course, I tend to get a better response from women 50 and over being concerned about health. They seem to be the chief keepers of the health for the family and themselves. But I have a number of men who have read the book. I have a number of younger folks who have read it, like in their 20s, which if you can get them to read it and understand, that's great. So it really is for anybody, but my target market specifically was women 50 and over.
Have you had any early feedback from target markets?
Yes, and it's been exactly what I was hoping it would be. I had a note from a friend who wrote and said, "Finally, I know what I need to do, and I can do it. You've given me the strength to be able to understand it." And that was a woman in her 40s. I got something from a male friend in his 60s who said, "This is exactly what I needed. I'm keeping it on my nightstand. I learned a few new things, but it reinforces." And for those of us in our, late 50s, 60s, health class was a long time ago. And health class back in the 60s and the early 70s really didn't get into anything of value. So this book really, I think, points out some critical areas for people to think about and make their decisions wisely.
Tell us more about the design of the book and the interaction with the reader.
Well, this was really a collaborative effort between Jennifer and myself, understanding what I was trying to do and who I was trying to reach. As I put the book together, I inserted personal stories because I thought that it would be helpful for people to understand that this isn't being written in a vacuum. This isn't being written just from research that was done. As I said earlier, I sort of experiment on myself as I do a lot of this stuff. And so I felt the need to at least interject some of my challenges and some of the things that I had to overcome as well. I'm definitely not perfect, and this is not about being perfect. It's about progress. It's about making steps to lead to better health. And in this environment now that we have, our bodies, our immune systems are our best protection for us. And so if I can help people think about that a little differently, that's good. So that's sort of one part is my personal stories and how I got there. Then there's some other tips I put in there about things like sugar. I mean, in my integrative nutrition course, they had experts. I mean, they had Dr. Oz, they had Deepak Chopra, they had a whole slew of really impressive people talk to us. And many of them talked about sugar being as addictive as cocaine. I never realized that before because I couldn't eat just one peanut butter cup. I'd have to have two, three, four, or the large size. And they talked about cheese being addictive. And I love cheese, and I've had to learn to moderate my taste for that. But those are the types of things that catch us off guard because we don't know. The marketing industry for foods is so pervasive. And our minds take over, and our bodies don't know how to act because our minds are telling us one thing, but our body says, "Help, I can't process it." So one of the other facts that besides sugar and cheese that I learned about was that over our lifetimes, we're going to eat 25 tons of food. Thinking about pesticides and chemicals that are used on some of the foods that we eat, or even in the chemical processing that is done of food, having a little bit's not bad, but having 25 tons, and 60% of adults eat processed food all the time, at least in the U.S. So, you got to be aware. You got to be aware so your body can function.
Well, then what do you believe to be the four components to good health?
Well, I put them right up front in my title, and some people are misinterpreting them because when I say drink, move, eat, and sleep, they're putting in their own, what do I drink? But the top four components are our bodies are made of a lot of water. We need to keep replenishing that water. We need the water to flow and not be stagnant underneath our skin. So we need to drink water. Now, I give examples of different types of water, so it's not just that you have to drink tap water, but there's, you know, you can drink some flavored waters. Just look at the sugar content. Look at the ingredients. Institute for Integrative Nutrition taught me how to read ingredients, which I never knew or took lightly before. So drink. Move. Exercise is extremely important. And I'm not just talking from the parking lot to your office or around the house. I'm talking about dedicated movement. So it could be that you go to the gym. It could be that you take the dog for a walk. It could be that you do yoga, but 30 minutes a day. And probably the best time, if you're going to just walk, which is the easiest and it's very effective, is to walk after your meals, because that gets the systems moving, that gets the digestion going. Eat is the third one, and eat basically is looking at your foods, trying to eat whole foods, trying to eat, if you can, organic but local, trying to get processed foods out of your diet. Processed foods have a lot of chemicals in them. Our body doesn't know what to do with the chemicals and basically stores it as fat, so if they can't excrete it. So that was probably the biggest aha for me when I was going through integrative nutrition, because I was trying to eat low fat, low this, low that. That was actually putting more chemicals in my body than if I ate the whole food, the natural food. So I eat 4% cottage cheese. I don't eat anything that says it has reduced calories, reduced fat. Nothing, because it's all usually done with chemicals.
You mentioned in the book that if you can't pronounce it, it must not be good for you.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at an ingredient, and you know, sometimes the ingredient is half the column on the side of the package, look for limited ingredients in something, you know, 4, 5, 6, you know, maybe 10. But if it has a bunch, look for organic ingredients, or look for things that are not cane sugar or fructose syrup, or, you know, look for things that are healthy to be in that processed food for you. So yeah, that's a big one.
Talk to us about how you can convey motivation to the reader best you can.
Well, that's always a tough one, especially when you're doing training. How do you motivate somebody? And quite honestly, I learned over the years, you don't. People have to be motivated themselves, which is why my target market is 50 plus women, because they seem to be more motivated at that point in their life. What I tried to do was just point out some facts, some maybe little known things to people to get them thinking. And as they think, perhaps they'll start considering, well, maybe I should eliminate this, or maybe I should be a little wiser when I might choose my foods, or, you know, maybe I can take this out of my diet. The whole thing with integrative nutrition that I thought was fascinating was Joshua used to talk about bio-individuality, that each of us are very individual in our food needs, our circle of life, the spirituality and health, etc. So, you know, these diet books and things that are out there are great for the person who wrote them, but they might not necessarily work for you. I think we studied 100 different diets in integrative nutrition, and the unfortunate part is they're not usually sustainable. You know, you can do it for a short period of time, maybe even a couple of months. But, you know, when you start depriving your body of something that you want, you just crave it more. And sometimes those cravings can actually be needs that your body has. Like, you know, a low-fat diet is not necessarily good because your brain needs fat. How do you think clearly if you're depriving your body of the fat that it needs to work? You know, it's been very interesting for me to learn all this stuff, and I'm just hoping that the book can help convey it.
Do you think the industry out there sets up people for failure with fad diets, as they're called, quick fixes that may net a small to medium weight loss and maybe a boost in your self-confidence, but you're not setting, let's say, steps and building blocks to long-term nutritional or health success? Do you believe in that? Is that true based on your perception?
I know for me personally, it's very true. I think I was on diets for, I'm going to say, 40-some years off and on, from my early 20s to my 60s. So yeah, for me, it wasn't sustainable. I would lose for a little while, and then I would gain more back. It was a yo-yo plus. And I've talked to a lot of people that have had that same experience. I think the books that are out there, there probably is really good intention. And for the author that wrote the book, that was probably a great aha moment for them in losing weight. But you have to, it's a life change. you have to consider that when you decide that you really want to be healthy and you want to age well, and part of my personal desire is to not have medication as I get older. It is because of what happened to my mother. I just don't want medication in my body. So for me to walk down that path, I need to eat well, I need to exercise, I need to drink water, I need to sleep well.
Tell us about those that you dedicate the book to.
Well, first and foremost, as you've already heard, my mother, Dorothy Manson, she was a real inspiration and a very lovely lady. I just felt very badly that I couldn't help her while she was alive, but hopefully I'm helping her memory now with this book. Justin Kelly is the chiropractor that I mentioned earlier. Justin worked over at Basile Chiropractic in Allentown. And if anybody knows where he is, I'm trying to reach him to give a book, but I can't find him. But he really started me understanding a little bit about herbs and a little bit about the body healing. And then, of course, David Winston, who is American Herbalist Guild, world-renowned herbalist, he just is terrific, and I've learned an awful lot from him, and I've probably taxed him a bit with my questions that are definitely not the usual ones among professionals. And then Joshua Rosenthal, who is the founder and director of the Institute for Integrative Nutrition. He is the one that helped me pull all the pieces together. I was searching for a couple of years after David's class because there was a missing piece, and I couldn't figure out what that missing piece was. I tried other alternative therapies, and it didn't click with me. And then the integrative nutrition was like, that's it. You know, it's the food connection. It's the lifestyle choices. That was what's important.
And then what else would you like to share with our listeners about aging well?
Well, I think it's never too late to start. I started at 68, 69, but our bodies are amazing. I mean, they just want to perform for us, and they'll do whatever they can to, you know, accommodate us. And that's why we get some of the bulges we get places, because our body's trying to figure out what to do with it because it doesn't make sense for our systems. But if we can treat our body, if we can get back to understanding the needs of the body and not necessarily the marketing messages that play in our head from the commercials and everything that sort of are propaganda for food and drugs, our bodies are incredible, and we need to honor them. There's a quote I have in here from choreographer and author Twyla Tharp said, "God gives you one gift. You get to be born. Thereafter, you've got to take care of yourself." You know, and so, yes, we may have some DNA things that maybe are a little hairy as far as giving us the health that we would like to have, but it's our lifestyle, it's our food choices that really are the biggest component of the life that we're leading today.
Fantastic. This is a quick read, just 102 pages, but chock full of important information and applications to daily life. Well, I'd like to thank Sally Handlin and her newly published book, Your Journey to Aging Well, Drink, Move, Eat, and Sleep. We appreciate you making time today for Lehigh Valley Discourse and being on the other side of the microphone, as you're not normally accustomed to. But thank you again.
Thanks, James. I appreciate it.
For support of WDIY, we thank our underwriting sponsors.
We've seen the concern in your eyes. You want to know if it's safe to see a doctor. The answer is yes. At LVHN, you'll see the steps we take to get you the care you need safely. At all our facilities, you'll see temperature checks for everyone, that we sanitize every surface, and that masks are required. What we look forward to seeing is relief in your eyes. Lehigh Valley Health Network. Put your health first at LVHN.org.